The Financial Freedom Show. It's really kind of, I think it's really beyond help at this point. Hey, there you are. Hope everyone's having a good night. You can see what kind of mood I'm already in. Appreciate a thumbs up when in the chat to let me know, you know, you can hear me, see me. And we'll get started. Some interesting questions already listed in the chat. One wants to know, by the way, if I have any stocks to suggest. I don't really. I'm not. This really isn't a stock picking kind of channel. I mean, I talk about what I invest in, not as a recommendation at all. I think it's actually a good thing to. I like the fact that I have part of my portfolio in individual stocks, even though the vast majority of it is in index funds. Okay, got the thumbs up. Good. So I will get back to the questions. Two things before we get to your questions. One is, did you see the channel went over 80,000 subscribers? I kind of feel like, you know, the home stretch maybe to 100,000. Maybe not. Maybe it'll be not, when we get to 90,000. But I can kind of see it, maybe. And then I get a plaque from YouTube. So the topic today, my little five-minute topic, three key components of a retirement withdrawal strategy. Really, maybe it could have been four. But one of them I kind of break into two. 1A and 1B. This came up because I'm working on a video on the Vanguard Dynamic Spending Rule, which many people have emailed me about. It's basically an approach to retirement spending where you use guardrails. I'll explain it all in the video, which I hope to have out tomorrow, but we'll see. But you know, it caused me to sort of do a deep dive. I mean, I've done this in the past, but look at withdrawal strategies in a certain way. And the thing is I think when most people first get introduced to the idea of how do we figure out how much we can spend in retirement, I think for most people, myself included, we start with the 4% rule, right? That's the first thing you hear about. And if you're like me, when you first hear about it, you don't realize that the 4% only applies in the first year of retirement. And then after that, you throw it out. It's irrelevant. Because after that, you just adjust for inflation. And so at some point in sort of the journey to trying to figure out, you know, how you can survive in retirement, you come to that realization. And then the next thing you realize is that the 4% isn't an average or a mean. It was the worst case scenario, at least based on U.S. data. And then you learn, it turns out that the 4% rule is really more broadly a constant dollar approach, meaning you adjust for, you know, you pick a number and then you adjust for inflation every year thereafter. And then you kind of learn, and it turns out there are dozens of other ways to do it. That's not the only way. You have, I'll just take out a percentage every year, or maybe a fixed dollar every year. Then you learn about guardrails. Well, I was trying to figure out what do all of these withdrawal strategies have in common? If I'm going to come up with a list of which I do have, of withdrawal strategies, what kind of information would I want for each one? Each one would kind of have to track certain key components. And I think it's helpful in sort of just stepping back and looking at the big picture of figuring this out for retirement, which, by the way, is important even if you're years away from retirement, because you kind of try to figure that out from a planning perspective so you know how much you have to save. I mean, it really comes down to the question, when can we retire, right? Well, it depends on how much we can spend each year with our savings, with, you know, out without going broke. And so the three components, I think, this is how I think about it. The first one, of course, is how do we calculate how much we can take out each year? And this is where I could have broken these into two, because they're really important. There's 1A and there's 1B. Since I've got the title of tonight's show as three key components, I got to make number one, 1A and 1B. 1A is the initial, the first, you know, year of retirement. What do you take out? And then 1B is how do you calculate how much you can take out thereafter? And in a lot of these, not all of them, but in a lot of the withdrawal strategies, just like the 4% rule, how you calculate the first year of retirement is completely different than how you calculate every year thereafter. Like, again, the 4% rule, you start, let's just say, with 4%. That's how you calculate year one. But in year two, you throw out the 4%. You take whatever number that generated and adjust it for inflation. So how you calculate year one is totally different than how you calculate the rest of your retirement, at least in theory, and if you were strictly following the 4% rule. And that's also true with like Guyton-Klinger, you know, these guardrails. And by the way, I had an email exchange with Jonathan Guyton. I think he's going to be on the show. We got to figure out a day. I don't know if it's going to be live or pre-recorded, but I'm working on that. But, you know, a lot of the withdrawal strategies, you know, you have how do I calculate the first year and then how do I calculate every other year thereafter? They can be two totally different things. And that's true with guardrails, right? Which, by the way, this is where all this kind of circles back to this video I'm working on. The Vanguard Dynamic Spending Rule uses guardrails. Now, not all retirement withdrawal strategies differ from year one versus the rest of the years in retirement, right? Because if you were just taking a set percentage each year, I'm going to take 5% every year. Well, of course, then it doesn't change. But I would say for most of them, it does. So that's point one of the three key components, 1A and 1B. Have I lost everyone? Okay. The second one is asset allocation, right? If you said, oh, I'm going to follow the 4% rule, but I'm going to have 100% in bonds, at least based on Bingen's work, it ain't going to work, or there's a good chance it ain't going to work. So asset allocation matters. And there's the whole topic, do we have international investments and all that? But asset allocation is a key component. You can't divorce it from the withdrawal strategy. Now, and then the third thing, and this all circles back, by the way, to 1A, the initial withdrawal in year one. It all comes back to that in a second. But the third thing is when we go to actually take the money out, we've decided we've used whatever method we're going to use. We know the number. We're going to take out 50 grand, whatever. How do we do it? What fund, not from a tax perspective, that's important too, but how do we take it out? What funds do we take it up from? Now, in some cases, depending on the strategy, it doesn't matter. Like you're just going to do the sort of the Bill Bingen approach. Let's say at the end of December, you take out your 50 grand and then you just rebalance back to whatever your asset allocation is. So you could have taken it all out of bonds or stocks. If you then rebalance, you know, you're back to whatever your asset allocation was. But some of the strategies are very specific about the order. And, you know, if stocks are up, you take out of stocks. And if this asset class is up, and then, you know, if all else fails, you're taking out of some cash. And Guyton-Klinger is that way. There's this sort of elaborate strategy, and you're not rebalancing back to some set plan, like maybe if you were following the Bill Bingen approach. There are others. There are spend all your bonds first. That's kind of a rising glide path, they call it, where in retirement you actually increase the percentage of stocks you have, stock investments, because you're spending all the bonds. You know, another approach is spend the stocks first. But the point is how you're going to take the money out, how you're going to actually harvest the income is one way to think about it. And it incorporates rebalancing potentially. Again, some of them don't have rebalancing. That's the whole sort of third component. Here's the interesting thing, and why I should have said four key components, but whatever, is that, stay with me, 1B, which is how we decide how we're going to take, how much we're going to take out in years two through when we die, right? Do we use guardrails or not? Do we adjust for inflation? Or, you know, how do we do that? That's a question we have to answer. What's our asset allocation? Another question we have to answer. And then when it comes to actually taking the money out each year, how are we going to do it? Which funds are we going to take from? Are we going to rebalance? How's that going to work? Those three things all dictate the initial withdrawal rate. Those are the things that go into how we figure out what we're going to take out in year one, which in many of these withdrawal strategies, again, if you followed it strictly, once you make that initial decision, it's critical because everything else flows through that. And you can see that clearly in the 4% rule, right? Once you decide, okay, I'm going to take out 4.3% and then adjust for inflation until I die, you know, that 4.3% decision is a big decision. Now, some would say, well, but that's all true. That's kind of theoretical, and it is. because I think as a practical matter, we're not going to come up with some strategy at age 60 or 65 or whenever you retire and then not deviate from it no matter what happens, right? For starters, life happens. So there might be good reasons apart from the market and inflation and all that, that we change how much we're spending in a given year. Or, you know, we could hit a 2022 high inflation, terrible market, and we just decide we're kind of a little nervous. We're gonna pull back a little bit on spending. So as a practical matter, I think we tend to make these sorts of adjustments. Some of the strategies are designed to help us make that adjustment. Again, with guardrails as an example. But I think it's important, and I know I've thrown a lot at you. It's like, man, Rob, this is a lot for 10 minutes, but I really think about these things, and I think it helps to understand the withdrawal strategy in these components, because they're all important, and those last three really go into how we're going to think about that initial withdrawal and what percent we're going to use. And it's never an exact science. We don't, you know, we can argue about what data we should look at, how far back should we go, should we use Monte Carlo simulations, should we use historical data, should we look at both? All good questions, and we can get all of this information, but it still doesn't tell us what the safe withdrawal rate is going to turn out to be given your choices about those other three components for, let's say, a retirement that starts in 2023. We can sort of use all of these things to make a reasonable guess about, you know, what we can safely spend, and then just be prepared to adjust it. And I think understanding it in that scope, I don't know, it helps me. Maybe it just confuses everyone. Maybe, I don't know. It helps me. That's how I think about it. That's it. That's all I had. A couple of quick questions. I'll get to your stuff now. You know, you're like, okay, Rob. Joshua is the one that asked me about individual stocks. I like the idea of maybe investing 5 or 10% in individual stocks if you want to. Mine's grown more than that, but it's still not, you know, a huge amount. I've told you, you know, in a live show earlier this year, I walked through the stocks I own: Apple, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, Berkshire, and Deere. I'm happy with all five of them. I'm probably least happy with Wells Fargo, not from a returns perspective, but man, are they a mess. And I'm not completely convinced they've got their act together. I mean, I understand the whole fake accounts thing was under prior management, but I don't know. Anyway, but those aren't recommendations. That's what I've chosen to do. Joshua mentions Microsoft and Amazon. If I were going to think about another stock, Microsoft would certainly be one that I would be seriously evaluating. I don't know about Amazon. I don't know that that would be high on my list personally, but all right. Another question, given the U.S. debt ceiling issue, do you recommend pulling out of I-bonds and T-bills? No, I'm not going to pull. I own both, and I'm not getting out of them. That's not to say we won't have an issue. We'll see. But what do you, you know, yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, we're going to pay our bills. It could get ugly. I just, you know, at the end of the day, we're going to get it done. That's my view anyway. Kalawish says, since both stocks and bonds are down, and I guess you're referring to 2022, do you take from your 401k cash portion, even if this triggers your opportunistic rebalancing numbers, and not rebalance in hopes of market recovers? That's not how I would do it. That's kind of, if I understand your question, it's kind of the bucket strategy, which, by the way, you know, we were looking at the, I'm going to start calling it the four key components, because I really do like separating out the initial withdrawal rate as a separate component. It really is a separate component. But the bucket strategy, in a way, is that last component where how do you decide what to pull out and do you rebalance or not? The bucket strategy, in a way, is an attempt to answer that fourth component question. I just don't think it answers it very well. you could certainly spend cash, but I mean, if you've got a certain asset allocation, the problem with, let's say you've got an asset allocation and it includes whatever, 5% cash, but you're going to spend the cash, so you won't have it, or, you know, if, over the course of this year, you won't have it. You're then forced to then answer a question you don't normally have to answer. And that is, okay, when do I, if I'm not going to rebalance and keep it in, whatever approach to rebalancing you have, opportunistic, you know, kind of deals with when your asset classes get out of whack by a certain amount. If you're not going to follow your plan, then what? What you're, effectively what you're saying is, see, I think what a lot of people do is they have a plan, but because they're, you know, the market, they decide not to follow it. So in, like in your case, maybe you spend the cash. So now you're operating without a plan. So one question would be, well, if you're not going to follow the old plan, maybe you should come up with a new plan, which would include maybe when you do the rebalancing to get back to your original plan. How do you answer that? That's a tough question. I've talked to a lot of people who, you know, made a decision. Like I know some people that went to cash at a good time, say end of 2021. But they tell me, it's funny. They say, look, I'm glad I did it. It's saved me some losses, but now I don't know when to get back in. I don't know when to get back into my plan. That looks kind of, I don't know. I'm looking at myself on the screen over here. This looks kind of dorky. Anyway, it's tricky. I mean, when you go off script, see, it looks like this and it feels like this. It doesn't look or feel very good. So then you got to figure out, okay, well, how am I going to get back on the plan? If you can answer that question, maybe you'll just say, I'm going to spend cash for this year. And at the end of this year, I'm going to get back to whatever my plan was. I don't care what the market's doing. But then you could be fooling yourself. I mean, what if the market's down again? Then what do you do? That's why I tend not to do that. You know, see, there I go again. See, it's the whole question. It's got me all bunged up. Where can I find long-term GDP projections for the U.S. and other countries? I have no idea. You could Google it or you could ask ChatGPT. Well, ChatGPT, they might know. I don't know. I mean, I'm pretty sure the Fed has projections on that. I don't know about other countries. They might. That's just a guess. Gary says, are you still doing the tax software review? I plan to. The issue is I needed to get enough of my own tax information gathered because I want to actually use, I'm probably going to limit it to 3 or 4 programs. Certainly TurboTax, H&R Block, maybe Tax Slayer, Tax Act, maybe those 4. But I want to actually use the software. So it'll probably be towards the end of the month is my guess when I can actually do that and then do a video. So Kat wants to know my thoughts on tips ladders versus tips funds. And that was an article. If you aren't subscribed to the newsletter, you could do that with a link below this video. It goes out every Sunday morning. I thought there was a very interesting article from Tips Watch, which is an excellent blog by a fellow. I don't even know his name, but he seems very, very knowledgeable about tips and IBAN, certainly more knowledgeable than I am. You know, I don't have an issue. I think either approach can work. The one thing I mentioned in the newsletter was that I didn't necessarily agree with everything in that article. You know, they were comparing investing in tips, individual tips, versus a fund. And they're pointing out, you know, the value of the fund, that's variable. But the tip, you know, you know what you're going to get if you hold it to maturity. And I'm thinking, well, in a tips fund, you kind of know what you're going to get if you hold it long enough, which is really the same thing you're saying about an individual bond. If you hold it long enough, that is to maturity, you know what you're going to get. So I'm personally not one to be concerned about the fluctuation in value of a bond fund. The one thing about, but I will say this, the one thing about buying individual tips is that you can get very specific on sort of the maturity of your portfolio. So you could say, okay, I need $50,000, in today's dollars, a year from now for 2024. So I'll buy a tip that matures then if they have them, they should, would be on the secondary market, but let's just assume they're there. And it's actually probably going to get you a real yield, which means not only will your money keep up with inflation, you'll make a little extra 1.5%, something like that. as opposed to having a tips fund that a year from now could be worth less. But here's the problem I have. Okay, well, what about the year after that? Well, we'll do a ladder, right? We'll have another tips that matures then. Okay, and what about the year after that? Well, do another tip. What about the year after that? Another one. And it's like, well, okay. Reminds me of the old story. I think I've got this right. So an elderly lady was at listening to a young professor type talk about the fact that the earth is round. And she said, no, it's not. And it's flat. And he said, well, if it's flat, what's it sitting on? She said, a tortoise. And he's looking around, well, okay. But what's the tortoise on? And she's, oh, that's very clever, Sonny, but it's tortoises all the way down. So we could just do tips. I don't know how far out. And you could say, well, we'll do it 10 years and the rest in stocks. Okay. But then a year from now, what do? You're short one. Take money out of stocks. I guess buy another tip. I don't know. At the end of the day, I'm not sure it solves at least a problem that I perceive. I think just having bond funds, stocks, rebalancing, it kind of works for me. But I think a tips ladder, if you know, you might say, well, I feel more comfortable because I've got it. It's predictable. I know it's inflation adjusted. It'll cover me for 5 years. Yes. Or whatever the number is. And yes, a year from now, I'll get another one that matures 5 years later. And I'm fine with that. I got no issues with that. Here's a tough question from VC. How consequential is asset location for someone in the 22% tax bracket? I just lost the comment. Things are jumping on me. Let's see here. Here we go. I don't think I can show this one on the screen yet. I'm getting close though, and I'll show you these on the screen. In the 22% tax bracket with a 90-10 portfolio, i.e., should I really care about treasury bonds in my brokerage? Well, it's only 10%. I don't know how much money we're talking about. 22% is Fed. I don't know if you're in a state that charges, that has income tax or capital gains, but you know, you'd want to factor in state income tax. But I'd still care about it, I think. But I think I would look at the dollars involved. I do own some bonds in a taxable account. And I said state income tax, but treasuries, if you're talking about treasury bonds, you don't pay state income tax on treasury bonds. So it may not be that big of a deal. But you know, I would want to think about numbers. Kentora says, "Do you have a favorite guardrail withdrawal strategy?" I don't yet. No. I kind of think of guardrails right now as a way to just make sure I'm not driving my financial life over a cliff in retirement. I don't right now use guardrails to actually change how much I'm going to spend. But now, in fairness, part of that is because I don't have to spend that much of our investments at the moment. And I don't foresee having to, where I would feel the need to use guardrails. I think the Vanguard dynamic spending rule, which I'll talk about in the next video, I think is a reasonable approach. It's a little... it's not that hard to use, but I don't. I mean, here's the thing you have to realize about guardrails. So at one extreme, you could come up with like a 4% number and then adjust for inflation through retirement. The problem is if inflation goes high, it could wipe you out. So you have to start with a low, initial withdrawal. Historically, 4%, maybe 4.5% has worked. Again, U.S. data. If you use international data, depending on what international data you use, it could be a little lower than that. But of course, we don't know what the future holds. But that's the problem with that approach. The other problem is I think almost nobody actually spends the same inflation-adjusted amount through retirement. But in any event, that's sort of on one extreme. The other extreme would be just take a percent. I'll take 4% every year. So the problem with that is that as your portfolio goes up or down, how much you take out can change dramatically, you know, from one year to the next. Like, you know, this year, you know, your market's down. If you were just doing, let's say, 4%, you know, you would have taken out a lot less in December than you did December 21. And a lot of folks have a hard time dealing with, you know, they just can't handle their finances, can't handle that fluctuation. And that can be a problem, but there is an advantage to that approach. And that is you can usually take out a higher percent. You know, you might take out 5% in year one because you're not adjusting it for inflation. Guardrails kind of, there's a lot of withdrawal strategies that try to take both of those extremes and piece them together in some way. Guardrails are one of those approaches, and you'll understand that when you see the video that I'll put out this week, because the Vanguard Dynamic Spending Rule does exactly that. It tries to use guardrails. Basically, what it does is it adjusts your spending every year by the rate of inflation, but then before you actually take it out and spend it, compares it to these guardrails and keeps it within that range. Another way to think about bringing these two extremes together would be an endowment approach or Yale spending rule. Because what the Yale spending rule does, here, I'll show it to you. This is FI Calc. I was actually looking at this. They have, I know we've looked at this a lot, but for those that aren't familiar with it, it's a way to test a lot of withdrawal strategies. One of them is, so they have the Vanguard Dynamic Spending. That's the one that I'll be looking at in the video. And you can click this link and it tells you about it, by the way. But they also have this endowment strategy. And I don't know how, let me see if I can make this bigger. Oh, good. This is what I want to show you. This is what, and they call it the Yale. In fact, they put it in here, Yale. Because if you think about a university with an endowment, so they're going to use that to fund research. Well, they don't want to shortchange current professors and labs and researchers, right? But they also don't want to give them so much money that they run out of money for future research. And unlike a retirement, the endowment's designed to live forever. And so they have to balance, you know, the needs of research today and the needs of research in the future. So what they did at Yale, and there are different formulations, but they said, okay, let's imagine they start with 5% in year one. And then what they do is they say, okay, whatever the previous year's withdrawal was, we're going to adjust it for inflation, but then we're going to multiply it by 0.7. So we're going to adjust it for inflation, but then multiply it, just take 70% of that number. And then for the rest of the year's withdrawal, we're going to take whatever the portfolio value was. Of course, it could have gone up in a good year, would have gone down in a bad year. We're going to take some percentage, and this tool uses 5. We're going to take 5% of it, and then multiply that by 30% and just add those two numbers together. So we're getting some inflation adjustment over here. And then we're also getting some that's just dependent on how the portfolio performs. So what this is doing is not unlike guardrails, but it's obviously doing it in a different way. It's taking the sort of the Bill Bingen 4% rule extreme over here and the just take a percent every year and using a little bit of both of them. And of course, you know, it used 70% for inflation adjusted, 30% for just taking a percentage of the portfolio. You could pick a different, you don't have to use 70 and 30. You could have picked something else and it uses a 5% of the portfolio, you know, maybe something different. Certainly wouldn't go dramatically higher. Anyway, and yeah, that's the deal there. And I realized I wasn't showing you the formula again, but here it is. Hopefully that makes sense. I'm actually going to talk a little bit about this, I think, in the video. I haven't recorded it yet. I've just done the research for it. Here's a good one. I'm currently dealing with a lower back injury at age 32. What has helped you the most? So I had terrible back issues since college. And about 12 years ago, it was just terrible. I'd get up in the morning and I'd have to like move around the bedroom for like 20 minutes to kind of be able to stand up straight. And I couldn't really run or jump. And I just started doing, the first thing that helped me was just weight training. But it was, you know, when I started, I was doing a lot of body weight and all core stuff. You know, before that, to me, a core exercise was a sit-up. But I'm doing planks, you know, planks where you're pulling heavy things underneath you, like a sandbag or something, or dumbbell or kettlebell. You know, a lot of kettlebell carries, different types of carries that we carry a kettlebell on one side, but you stay upright. So you have to engage your core. Otherwise, you know, the weight of the kettlebell will pull you over. So a lot of core stuff, and that helped. And then I think more recently, you know, I've been doing a lot of yoga. I did yoga this morning and I was stiff this morning. My back didn't feel great, but, and Pilates, that helps a lot. But getting into shape, working a lot on your core, that's what helped me. But, you know, I'm not a doctor and everyone's different. And, you know, some people could have, you know, I mean, I have like a disc issue, but some people have more serious issues. So that's what's helped me. All right. I'm going to come back over here where I can actually look at the, put up some of the questions. I hope I've probably skipped some and I'm sorry. Rob has an interesting question. Do ETFs and mutual funds actually own the shares listed in the portfolio? Yes, they better. Yeah. Why wouldn't they? Yeah. If everyone sold at the same time, there's two different things. So when you sell an ETF share, you're selling it to another investor, not back to the fund. But with mutual funds, you are selling it back to the fund. And yeah, they could. I mean, that's kind of what happened with the Vanguard target date fiasco, you know, with taxes. Not everyone sold, but a lot of people, a lot of institutions sold. And they had to sell shares to cover it. And that's what triggered all the capital gains. By the way, I have on my calendar. So I've been in touch with the lawyers representing the plaintiffs in the class action. And I think it's the end of this month. I have it calendared to reach back out to them. Because what's happening is, I think they're filing a motion to dismiss. Which is normal. That's, you know, trying to think if I ever defended a federal lawsuit in which I didn't file a motion to dismiss. Probably not, but they usually get denied. Not always, though. All right. We got a first timer. Welcome. I would like sound the applause. I have some sound keys over here. Yeah, I'm not very good at that sort of thing. Here's one about the Howard Marks article, Sea Change. That was a couple of weeks ago, and I would have to go back and refresh. I mean, I remember the article, but not well enough to like have some thoughtful comments to give on it. May I reread it? Here's a good question from Bob. Is there a best way to go from 12 funds to only 3 or 4? Well, the first question is, are you asking that from a tax perspective? I don't have any... I get that a lot when folks have, you know, complicated portfolios, usually created by an advisor in a brokerage account. And I don't, you know, I just don't have any easy answers for that. Assuming there's, you know, embedded gains, but if it's in a retirement account, just pick the portfolio you want and change them all up. Yeah. I don't think there's anything special today. The thing is, here's the reality though. It gets unnerving, doesn't it? Like when you're moving around, wherever you are in your sort of life and journey, it's a lot of money, right? It doesn't matter if you're talking 5,000, 50,000, 500,000. And you start moving that kind of money around to simplify a portfolio. It kind of gives you, you get kind of nervous. It's like, what if I click the wrong button? Does the money just disappear? How does this work? But yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, apart from taxes, which I don't have any advice on that, it's just a matter of buying and selling to get to what you want. Okay. No, I'm not. So David says, if cash makes up 2% of your portfolio, which is about, that's what my plan is. It's a little funky right now because we've got a little extra cash because we're going to be spending it. So it's, I could just pull it out of my portfolio, but in any event. And a few years of expenses, are you then on board with the bucket strategy? Here's the issue with the bucket strategy. that I have. I don't want to base my asset allocation on years of expenses. Now, I might, at least not completely, I might pick my cash percentage with an eye on how many years can I live off of it. So in that sense, maybe. But like if you're at, if I'm at 70-30, for example, stocks to bonds, and the 30% includes the equivalent of 2% in T-bills, I'm rebalancing to that, you know, periodically. I don't do it annually unless, you know, I might, depends on what the changes are. But the thing that I don't like is when people have a cash bucket, say an intermediate bucket, and then a long-term bucket, and they're rebalancing based on those years of expenses. Because effectively what happens, you're always going to spend a year of cash. So how do you refill it? Well, the intermediate term bucket. Okay, well, how do you refill that? Well, the long-term bucket. Okay, so you're just basically selling a year's worth of stock every year. I mean, so the point is the buckets don't help you. Now, some would say, wait a minute, Rob, I got you there. In a bad market, I won't sell that. I won't have the buckets flow down. I've got whatever, 3 years of cash. You know, I'll just spend another year of cash. Okay. Well, when do you stop doing that? Like, is it when the market for a year, I guess an arbitrary time period, but okay, is up? Or like, you know, think about it this year. Well, you spent cash last year. Maybe you're down to 2 years of cash. So you're spending cash again this year. When do you stop spending cash? Is it when if the market's up this year, or does it have to get back to where it was in December of 2021? Because it could be up 5% this year and you're still down. All of these sorts of questions, and then by the way, when the market's down, particularly when it's down in a normal year, meaning bonds aren't down as much as they were, you don't want to just not be selling stocks. You want to be buying more. So should we have the buckets start to flow, I guess, upstream, so to speak? The bucket strategy really appealed to me when I first started thinking about retirement and sold my business and, okay, let's figure this out. And I planned to use it. And then I started trying to implement it. And I'm like, this is a mess. Indy Dave, thank you. Appreciate it. 80,000 subscribers. I don't know. I'm looking forward to 100. Let's see. So Fast Eddie wants to know, when you add your 2 years of cash, when you retire, do you take 2 years of cash and emergency fund become one? So in my mind, it's 2% for me. I think that's what it was. But I kind of work it out in my mind, you know, as to what that might look like in terms of actual expenses, just for a peace of mind kind of thing. But yes, I just, you know, I have it. I don't have a separate emergency fund. You know, it always gets a little more involved. So like, for example, I have a business, so I have a checking account. So there's cash in there that I don't include as part of my portfolio. But in my mind, I think, but I could spend it if I had to, right? And I always keep a month or so of cash in the checking account. So each month I fill it back up to a certain number that is a month, maybe a month and a half. I'm trying to think, you know, I have a number. I don't know. Depends on what month. Some months it doesn't seem to go quite as far. And those things aren't really part of what I think of as my portfolio. But at the end of the day, it's kind of rounding errors, so to speak, if that makes sense. Uh-oh, Noreen, I don't know if you've caught any, but apparently there have been sex bots, which I never see. It's probably because by the time I get down in the chat, Noreen has already taken care of them. All right, we've got a personal capital question. This is from Nitban. I invest in a Fidelity 401k target date fund at my work. Personal capital can read the total value of it, but cannot read the asset allocation. That's interesting. I don't know why that would be. I don't know if it's a Fidelity issue. Well, personal capital is reading any data Fidelity will give them. But it really surprises me that it doesn't give them that data. You might reach out to personal capital I know when I had a balanced fund, it read it, but I don't know. It's a good question. I wish I had an answer for you. Adam wants to know my thoughts on an economic soft landing. Better chance of it now than a few months ago. Well, I don't know. These things happen really slowly until the end, and then they happen quickly. We've seen inflation soften a little bit, but it's still, of course, far, far above what the Fed wants to see. You know, maybe the next hike is only 50 basis points. We'll see. But I think the whole question of soft landing comes down to jobs. And I'm no economist, but I think many would say you can't get inflation down to what the Fed wants without a much higher unemployment rate. So, you know, can that happen gradually and not create a big recession? Maybe, but I kind of, in my mind, it's still a very much an open issue. You know, they talk about, in fact, Ben Bernanke, here it is. I've got the book. Hang on. Right here. He talks about this idea of, I forget the term for it, but it's basically the unemployment. Is it U star? Is that what they call it? U asterisk? It might be. But in any event, it's what's effectively the lowest unemployment we can have without triggering inflation. And but that's not a number. There's no single answer to that question, or there might be at any given time, but it changes over time. And you only know it in hindsight. And, you know, one of the problems in the 70s apparently was they got it wrong. So I don't know what it is today. I don't know if the Fed discloses their view of that. Maybe. But in any event, Adam, I don't have a strong opinion one way or another. I think the fact that things have held up okay so far is encouraging, but I still think they could get ugly pretty quickly. We'll see. I still think unemployment has to go up, though, for the Fed to reach their goals. I must have missed the original question. Added to Shiller PE question above. I didn't see the Shiller PE question. Must have missed it. So Conscience wants to know my thoughts on Paul Merriman for fund versus Warren Buffett portfolio. So I'm not a fan. I wouldn't personally use Warren Buffett portfolio. His portfolio, by the way, for folks that don't know, it's 90% S&P 500, 10% basically T-bills, I think. I much prefer a more diversified. I like smaller companies. I like international companies. So I wouldn't pick a Warren Buffett fund. Paul Merriman's four fund, I think is great. I don't remember the exact funds. I could look it up. I know he tilts to value, which I don't have an issue with, but I in fact, over big chunks of my investing time period, I've tilted to value a lot. Yeah, a lot, particularly in small cap. And but I think as I've gotten to a point in life, I'm more probably middle of the road for me. But having said all of that, to answer your question, I would pick the Paul Merriman Four Fund over Warren Buffett portfolio, if those were my two choices. Yeah, this is interesting, Jeremy. So the question is, thoughts on using factor analysis and portfolio visualizer to compare funds? Chris from Merriman Foundation showed this on a recent podcast. Have you tried this approach? So I haven't, and maybe I'll work on doing it. I'll show you guys. I've not used this part of the tool. I watched the video you're referring to and found it fascinating. The one open question in my mind is I'm not sure I would be comfortable relying on factor analysis to actually make an investing decision. I'm trying to remember. Here's the portfolio visualizer. I think it was the factor regression tool that he used. Is that what he used? Yeah, because you can use Fama French, which I think is the one he picked, but I don't remember everything he put in here. If someone can email me the link, I can drop it in the newsletter on Sunday. And if you don't, I'll try to find it myself so people can watch the video. Or if someone has it, maybe well, you guys, I don't think you can put links in the chat, but we'll figure it out. It's an interesting video, and I do plan to watch it again if I can find it. But I watched it once and thought the analysis was very interesting. By the way, just to put some context to that, the Fama French, they had three-factor model, then they went to five factors. But it's the concept is what explains the market returns, you know, and you have the capital asset pricing model and this idea, and Sharp, this idea, it's just the sort of the market risk. But what Fama French, their three-factor model said, well, we can add to that. It's also small cap and value. They have names that I've never truly understood how these naming conventions came about. I should look it up, but it's like big minus small, or is it small minus big? Anyway, but it's basically small cap and value. Then they came out with a five-factor model that looks into profitability. But this video uses this to compare. I think he used a three-factor model, as I recall in the video, but I could be wrong about that. But looked at those factors comparing, I guess it was AVUV and maybe a Vanguard fund. Again, I'm going by memory, so. This is a good question. Anyone else thinking of dropping Morningstar with their pending portfolio manager change to Investor? I actually am not renewing my subscription to Morningstar, although I didn't really use their portfolio tool that much anyway. It's hard to find a tool. One of them that I've played with in the past is Stock Rover. And they're an advertiser, but I don't talk about them much because I don't use them regularly. But here they are. You could check them out. They actually pull in a lot of their data from Morningstar. But let's see, what are their plans? Yeah, you know, it's not cheap. Well, it depends what you get. I just, you know, so that's an option, I suppose. But I need to do some more research on alternatives. Now, of course, for Morningstar research, I think they're great. I'll continue to use that, but that's free. VC, this your question, I'm guessing that is with his recent article, which was fascinating. I don't know that he actually wrote it, but yeah. I'll put that on the list. That's going to take some research. Here's a great question. Is there a bulletproof safe withdrawal rate that can last with an early retirement and never run out? Dividend yield only, ~3%. So it's a great question. The short answer is no. There is no full bulletproof. I mean, you know, I did this video about Ben Felix and his 2.7% withdrawal rate. It really wasn't as much about Ben. By the way, great YouTube channel. Highly recommend it. He's terrific. It was really more about a research paper that he referenced that I'd read before. But it looked at other countries, and in fact, actually, what we can do, maybe even a Wade Fowle article is better. Hang on for a second. I'll pull it up and show it to you. I just got to go to my YouTube channel. Ben Felix, here it is.
Is the 4% rule on safe?
So here's my video. And in this, I linked to Ben's article or video, but I wanted to show you this. So this is to 1986. He looked at what the safe withdrawal rate would be based on you know, if you've invested in these different countries, like, you know, imagine you're from whatever, Norway, 2.99. Whoops. Look at Austria, 0.07. Japan, 27 bips. I mean, you know, at these levels, Italy, 81, France, 83, Germany, 101. What do all these have in common? Bueller. I don't know. It's just a reference. You know, you got World War I and or World War II. So, and that's kind of the point of the paper in a way. World War III could happen here and all bets are off. There could be a climate event. All bets are off. There could be some global cyber war, right? So now what some would say, and I might put myself in this category, and that is, okay, you're right. Those things could happen. And frankly, if they do, you're probably not going to be watching the Financial Freedom Show with Rob talking about safe withdrawal rates. We're going to have bigger issues. You're going to be watching some sort of survival YouTube channel trying to figure out how to dig a bunker. I don't know why I'm laughing. This is terrible. But the point is, any of those things could happen. Now, one way to look at a safe withdrawal rate is say, okay, great. You're right. That happens. All bets are off. But what if that doesn't happen? What does history tell us about a safe withdrawal rate? You know, maybe we don't have the best market returns and the best inflation like, say, the U.S. did over the last 100 years. Maybe we're somewhere in the middle of the pack, but, you know, we don't have World War III. Because that's really what we can plan for. We can't plan for a 7 basis point safe withdrawal rate, right? How do you plan for that? But even then, it's kind of a guesswork. When I look at historical data, if things don't go horribly wrong, I view 3% as pretty safe. But it's not a guarantee. Now, the other thing I'll say is the dividend yield's got nothing to do with it. If you have a portfolio that sort of right down the middle covers the market, and it happens to have a 3% yield, it wouldn't today, great. But if you then say, well, the yield today is only 1.5%, so I'm going to construct a different kind of portfolio to get the 3 or 4% yield, you're likely, not necessarily, but there's a good chance you're sacrificing total return, and that will hurt you in the end. Now, you know, some people can tilt to value, like the Schwab fund we've talked a lot about. And so, you know, we're still more or less down the middle of the road of a pretty well-diversified portfolio. It's not taking extreme bets. In my mind, that's probably okay. But the dividend yield itself is not going to save us. It's what will determine the success of our retirement. It will be total return. It's always total return, in my opinion. Do you ever see The Good Wife? That judge should always say to the lawyer arguing the case, in your opinion. Yes, Your Honor, in my opinion. All right. So this is interesting. Here it is. From Gabe, spoke with my Vanguard financial advisor. She said Vanguard is pretty bullish on international index for the next 10 years. Okay, time for a poll. Here we go. Start a poll. Will international funds outperform U.S. over next decade? Now, the point isn't that we're not trying to predict. This is just your best guess. We obviously don't know. Yes or no? Hope I spelled everything correctly. I suspect, here's one thing that Vanguard may be thinking. Let's compare two funds. We'll go to VTI and let's see here. I'll show you this on the screen in just a second. We'll look at VXUS. What are the PEs? I think Morningstar uses a forward PE, meaning it's the price is today's price and the earnings are the projected earnings, I think. But it'll be apples to apples because we're going to look at both of them in Morningstar. So this is a, you know, U.S. total stock market. PE of 16.4. And this is VXUS portfolio 1184. That's a huge difference. And you could look at other things. So I'm sure all their valuation metrics are going to be lower. 144 for price to book versus 298. So the price to book is twice as much for the U.S. as it is international. What's price to cash flow? U.S. is 9. International, 581. So if I were answering the question I just asked you all, I would say, yes, international, my best guess. Again, I'm not changing the way I invest based on any of this. But my best guess, let's see, well, how have you guys answered it? Well, 71% say no. All right. My answer to this, although I can't vote in my own poll, which I just think is wrong. In fact, I think I should be able to vote multiple times. It's my poll. Anyway, I would have voted yes. But I guess, look, if we're still doing this show at 2030, what year is this now? 2033? So someone, Vinyl, can you remember, Noreen? Remind me of this 10 years from now. Okay. Kalawish, I will. That's one of my big questions. Like, does he have a spreadsheet? This, we're talking about Jonathan Guyton, and because his the Guyton Klinger, that's the two gentlemen who wrote the paper that is sort of based on Guyton. Jonathan had written other papers, and I'll have to do more research before the interview, but I'm sure he's written others. It's a somewhat involved. There's a couple moving parts to this whole approach to this whole withdrawal strategy that's kind of become known as the Guyton Klinger. In fact, FI Calc, did it have Guyton Klinger? I don't even remember. Do we look at that? Yeah. So going back here, here's Guyton Klinger, right? And let me make this a little smaller. I think I got it. Here we go. You have, I don't even know if this encompasses all of it. This modified withdrawal rule thing, which you can, you know, you can pull this up and look at it. Then there's the capital preservation rule. There's the prosperity rule. My recollection, the last time I compared this to their paper, was that this doesn't actually account for everything in the paper, but I could be wrong about that. Yeah, it's kind of involved, is the point. All right. You know, one other thing I want to say about the whole withdrawal strategy and like my intro monologue at the beginning. There's so much variability from person to person. So, for example, you may, and I was looking at one comment, what triggered this thought was, here we go, this comment right here from Larry, I guess. We have two federal pensions, no debt, not taking Social Security until FRA, full retirement age, and don't need to touch the IRA or the TSP. So, you know, if you can live off your pensions and eventually Social Security, you might view your portfolio as just your fund spending. I mean, it might be vacations, hobbies, you know, whatever. And that could dictate what withdrawal strategy you use. You might say, look, Rob, I'm going to go with just a straight up percentage, 5%. And yeah, it'll vary wildly from year to year, potentially, but I don't care because it's not what we use to eat with, you know. We don't have to pay the gas bill, the you know, the air conditioning bill with that money. That's so, you know, your personal circumstances will often drive, you know, the withdrawal strategy that you pick, and could also drive your initial withdrawal. You might say, I'm going to take out 7%. Yeah, I mean, I might have to curtail that significantly, but that's okay. It's fun money, and I want to have more fun in my 60s and 70s than I'll likely have, you know, when I'm 90. Fun, you know, in terms of like a lot of travel and stuff. All right. Here's a long question or comment, and they didn't, I can't even get it all on there. I'll have to take it off because when I do that, I then can't read it either. I don't believe any of these strategies apply to early retirees such as myself that have a budget requiring the liquidation of only 2 to 3% of the portfolio assets. I'm currently living 100% off my portfolio assets, and I've been doing so for almost 5 years. I'll be again collecting a modest pension. I'd rather see a strategy that computes a maximum withdrawal percent in a given year based on the aggregate expected return of the portfolio, expected remaining life, and perhaps other factors. Well, if you think about an RMD, it doesn't use expected returns, but it does use expected life, right? And you know what else does is the Boglehead variable approach. Well, kind of. Actually, now that I think about it, they assume you'll live to 100, but you could use their tables, I think, putting in life expectancy or something like that. Although I would probably never use it to actual life expectancy, because that's going to be for most people in their 80s, right? So I'd probably want to assume more than that. But 2-3%, I mean, you know, at least based on historical standards, you should never run out of money. Of course, you might, because we don't know what the future holds. But all right, let's see where the poll ended up. I think 66% say no. All right. Well, I guess we'll find out. I'll end that. What's the next question? So 365, who apparently is on vacation, 365 days a year. That's phenomenal. I don't know what you do during a leap year, but it's pretty good. If you're taking out a set amount, what do you do at the end of the year when you have money left over? I mean, I think, you know, you're spending it all on December 31st. I probably wouldn't reinvest it. I would probably carry it over to the next year and add to it, assuming I was going to spend it next year. It's probably what I would do, just because it's the easiest thing to do. I suppose if it were a lot of money and you weren't going to need it, yeah, I might reinvest it, but I'd probably just carry it over to the next year, I think. Remember, if you want me to like focus on your comment, just tag me. Yippee wants to know if the three fund portfolio is tax efficient. Are bonds the problem? Could one replace VBTLX with the more tax efficient VWIUX? So first of all, the three fund portfolio itself, I think, is generally very tax efficient. Certainly the U.S. and international sort of Vanguard or maybe Fidelity low-cost index funds are fairly efficient, right? They're not distributing, certainly the Vanguard are not distributing capital gains. Dividends are minimal. I have to look up VW. I'm sure I'll know it. Well, maybe I won't. VWIUX. Oh, it's tax exempt. So, well, tax exempt would be an option. Depends on your tax bracket, if that makes sense. Because, you know, the higher your tax bracket, the more of a benefit you get. You know, treasuries don't have state income tax, so that could be consideration. Also, it depends on the dollar amounts we're talking about. Now, having said that, I would still probably prefer to put them in, like, you know, have a BND or some kind of total bond fund and put it in a IRA. I wouldn't put it in a Roth IRA, though. If my only choice were a Roth or taxable, well, part of it would depend on the allocation, right? Because a three-fund portfolio can have different allocations. But, you know, if you're at 10% or 20% in bonds, maybe you have some of it in like a tax-exempt fund, a municipal bond fund, maybe a little bit in treasuries. I like stocks and Roth IRAs because they're you know, it's going to be tax-free. So I want that account to get as fat as a tick, I like to say. Hat tip to my mom. Barry says, new viewer, what are your thoughts on fixed indexed annuities? So I'm just not a big annuities fan. I mean, if it's like a single premium immediate or deferred annuity, maybe it could be part of a retirement planning. But the more complex, the annuities that try to combine, and I don't know what specific annuity you're referring to, but they try to combine a permanent life insurance that, by the way, almost nobody needs with some sort of investment and cash account. I'm not a fan. They're expensive. And I just don't think for the vast majority of people, in my view, they're not useful or necessary. I would say this, if you're considering one, hire like an hourly financial advisor who's not in the business of selling them to do an evaluation for you. Because what the salespeople will do is make all of these assumptions and show you these rosy numbers. There'll be plenty of disclosures that say, these assumptions may not prove out and you could, you know, lose a lot of money, or words to that effect. But that's not what they're going to show you in the presentation. So buy an hour or two of time of a, you know, a good advisor who's just charging you like an hourly fee and get their view. All right. Dave wants me to ask what folks' personal rate of inflation was, but here's the thing: like, I wouldn't know that for me. But we'll ask. I'll say, obviously, this assumes you know it. We'll do it this way. What percent did your spending go up in 2023? Whoops, 2022. What are your options? 3% or less. I like it. I'm going to do 4 to 6%. Then we'll do 6 to 8%. And then we'll do 8%+, I guess. I'm trying to think if I could even figure that. I mean, I have my, here's the problem. I have my spending. Well, I don't have all my spending for 21 because I fouled up my Tiller money spreadsheet a year ago. I didn't foul it up this year. So I don't actually have all of my 21. I might maybe be able to recreate it. I do my budget. I know you could track it in other tools like Personal Capital, which I've used and stuff. But for my real budget, I use Tiller. And I don't think I have that data. I don't know what it would be. Plus, for me, it's hard because some years my spending goes up or down, not because of inflation, because I'm just buying more stuff. But maybe some of you might know this. So there you go. We'll see what they say. I kind of just laugh at some of your back and forth. You guys are funny. I got another poll suggestion. Rick, I'll do yours next. That's a good one. I'm getting this question here from Victor. VSIAX, aren't they the same thing? Isn't just one the... Well, VXUS, we know. I just don't know what the mutual fund version of it is. I just can't remember, but we'll look it up. Oh, no. VSIAX. So, by the way, this is VXUS. And you probably can't read it, but the Admiral Share version is VTIAX. You've asked about VSIAX, which is what? There are two. I wonder if you meant VTIAX, because VSIAX is the Vanguard Small Cap Value Fund. So they're totally two different things. If you meant VTIAX, you know, if I'm at Vanguard, I'm going to get the mutual fund. If I'm somewhere else, I'm going to get the ETF because there's just no fees for the ETF somewhere else. That's my view. And if you meant VSIAX, they're just, you know, they're two totally different things, right? Small cap value versus international. Noreen, are things getting chippy in the chat? This is interesting to me anyway. BJ says, my Peloton worked wonders for my back pain. I wouldn't have thought that would be true, but good. Kingdom of Finance says, Rob, love your channel. Thank you. Vinyl says, Rob is a sharp lawyer. He knows the drill. I might, but I have no idea what's going on in the chat. I can't wait to, like, when the show's over, go back and read it. I have no idea what's happening. Something's happening. I watched all three football games yesterday, but it felt like I watched 37 games. I mean, it took forever. I don't know why. That return by the Bengals, what was it, 98 yards? What a play. All right. And I am watching the game tonight. It actually comes on in 5 minutes. I don't know when kickoff is, but is there a Manning cast tonight? That's really the most important question anyone can ask, because I think there's a Manning cast tonight, which would just make it great. Yes. There's Manning cast tonight. I am so happy. They're terrific. All right. My goal in life is to be a guest on the show. Not really, because who would want to watch that? But I guess I'd probably have to become like a famous movie star, or I could try to play in the NFL. That would not go well. I could like kick off, but it probably wouldn't go more than 10, 15, maybe 20 yards. If it got a good bounce, maybe. Okay. I don't know where all this is going. Well, Phil asked the question, is it wise to add individual stocks to an all ETF portfolio for greater gain potential? The way you put that question, Phil, my view would be no. I think a lot of folks, and I guess I put myself in this category to some extent, you've got your mutual fund or ETF portfolio, but there's just part of you that enjoys analyzing stocks to a degree, and many of you far more than I do. But you know, and you want to put some relatively small amount, 5-10%, let's say, into a handful of individual stocks, and it sort of just scratches that itch that you have, right? Or some people might want to put a few percent in crypto. Which I don't, but although Bitcoin I think's been up like the last couple of days, right? Bitcoin price, didn't it go over 20? 21,000. It's funny how as the price goes up, it's perceived as a better investment. It's like, you know, but you complain about $6 eggs. I don't get it. Well, I get why you complain about the price of eggs, but in any event. You know, there are days when I toy with the idea of buying some gold. I don't. I might in the future. Who knows? I don't like the tax on gold. Of course, you could do a gold mining company in any event. But the point is, if you've got some relatively small portion of your portfolio that you want to sort of designate for these purposes, I try to avoid doing dumb things with it. You know, as a general rule, because it's still important. I think that's okay. That's kind of what I did. It just sort of grew out of hand a little bit. And by that, I mean, as a percentage of our portfolio, it's now like, I forget whatever it was when I did the portfolio review, maybe 18%, something like that. I don't think so. So Josh says, do you think the layoffs on Wall Street have anything to do with the increase in indexing? I really don't. I think it's probably more to do with a slowdown in deals and that sort of thing, financing. I don't think, my hunch would be it's got nothing to do with index funds. So Rick wants to know my thoughts on the major changes in the SECURE Act. I did a video on it. I like a lot of them. I like the change where you can roll over a 529 to an IRA. You know, one question that someone asked me in an email, so it's the beneficiary that can do this, but one person said, can't you set up a 529 account where you're the beneficiary? I find it hard to believe they will allow you to do that and roll it into a Roth IRA, but I don't actually have the answer to that. But putting aside those sort of interesting questions, I think it's a good change because a lot of parents or grandparents, you know, you're nervous, you know, I put all this money in there. What if Johnny or Susie doesn't go to college? Well, you can put it into an IRA for them. I like pushing out the RMDs because it gives more time for Roth conversions. You know, a lot of people, some people sort of complained about it from a policy perspective because, hey, it really only helps the people that can afford not to spend that money. And I get that. I don't know, you know, I don't know that I have a strong feeling on the policy part of it. But in the event, Rick, I did a video on it that kind of walked through them. I don't recall any of them that I thought were terrible. I'm trying to remember. Those are the ones that come to mind. I just did the video like 2 weeks ago. By the way, let's go back to the poll. So look at this. 19% of you saw your costs go up by more than 8%. That's rough. And 19%, 6 to 8%. And 32%, 4 to 6%. Yeah, that's a rough year. I'm going to end this poll and ask you a different question. Not the one that someone suggested a minute ago, but did you see... No, I'll do it differently. If you watched my YouTube short, which is a video that's 60 seconds or less, if you watched my YouTube short video this week, did you like the format? And I'll tell you what it is for those that didn't watch it. I start off by saying everybody knows that if you invest, you know, blah, 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 in an IRA for this long, you end up with this much money. But did you also know that only a small portion of it comes from contributions? A big part of it comes from, you know, compounding. Well, now you do. That's the format. And I've only done one video like that, but I really liked the format. I'm thinking that, and I even put it on TikTok. Yeah, you didn't know I had a TikTok account, did you? I think I have like 4 videos published. But I liked that format. I'm going to use it regardless of the vote, by the way. But I would be curious to know if you liked it. Okay. So Stephen wants to know if I started with, say, some percent, 5 to 10%, and it's grown to more than that, why not rebalance? Because I don't see that as the same thing as rebalancing. I'm not rebalancing between what percentage I have in stocks. My asset allocation isn't about what percentage I have in stocks versus what I have in funds, for example. So I don't think of it that way. It largely grew bigger than I would normally want because of Apple. And I still think it's a good investment. So I don't see a reason to sell it and then trigger the capital gains. And we're using it to fund charitable giving. So it will, over time, come down, unless Apple keeps going, you know, up and up and up, which I don't, I mean, it can't, right? Nothing does. So that's kind of my thinking. And I feel comfortable with the risk when I look at our overall financial picture. So, you know, it's funny, Mr. Wonderful, Kevin O'Leary, I don't mean to pick on Kevin. I enjoy like listening to him, and I don't really watch Shark Tank. I mean, I've seen it, but he's funny about this whole FTX and crypto thing, because I've heard him say two things that were interesting to me. One was he would never invest in a stock that doesn't pay a dividend. Okay. I don't know if he owns Berkshire, but he would never invest in a stock that doesn't pay a dividend. And he would never, and this is your point, your question, Stephen, he would never hold a position that's greater than 5% of his portfolio. Okay. I get that. Those are, I don't have any issues with those, but then he invests in FTX and crypto. Like, well, crypto doesn't pay a dividend. FTX, I mean, maybe it was for him, a relatively small amount of money. And then if that's the case, I get it. You know, I mean, he's obviously very wealthy, so I'm assuming he's worth hundreds of millions. I guess I don't know. But so if he, you know, not that losing 10 or 15 or 20 million is a fun day, but it's not like it's going to, you know, change his life. Maybe some of the lawsuits will, I don't know. But it just struck me as a little odd, like very I don't know if I'd say conservative, but yeah, kind of conservative with the dividend investing and no more than 5%. And then we're going to invest in this company run by a kid in the Bahamas. I don't know. Seems kind of odd to me. But anyway, that's my best answer to your question, Stephen. I don't know. Is that inconsistent? I don't think it is, but maybe it is. All right. 80% liked it. Good. 20% of you didn't. Well, that's okay. All right. I'm going to ask, I know we're getting near the end, but I'm going to ask one other question. Thank you for answering that. Are you retired or about to retire? I guess I'll put it that way. What are my options? 10 plus years to retirement. 5 plus years to retirement. We'll add an option. Retired in last 5 years and retired more than 5 years ago. I'm not going to check for typos. I'm just going to send it. Let's see here. Noreen, thanks for promoting the newsletter. I'm almost to 10,000. We've almost got 10,000 subscribers. And I'll tell you, the thing about newsletters, so I had a newsletter before that I sold as part of my business 5 years ago. This newsletter is different because, like my old newsletter, a lot of the people that signed up didn't know anything about me. They were coming to the site I owned at that time, like through search engines, and we would promote the newsletter and they'd sign up. I think most of the signups that I have for this newsletter come from this YouTube channel. And the result is I have what's called an open rate. So for every 100 recipients of the newsletter, how many people open it and read it? Well, about 70% do, which in the business is phenomenal. It's like ridiculous. And I also think part of it is because it's a fairly focused newsletter. Although I am having a lot of fun with if you wonder what those initials mean, in case you missed it, that section of the newsletter, which is basically any article or I found interesting. That's what goes in there. That's in some ways, that's my favorite part of the newsletter. All right. One thing I want to add to the newsletter this week, if I can remember, is a link to the archives. Because I get requests for, can I see the archives? And the archives go back only so far because it's available with the platform I'm using now, and I switched newsletter providers sometime last year. But I will include that if I can remember in the newsletter this week. I don't think I've done one on the Yale Endowment portfolio. Right, it's not a portfolio, it's a withdrawal strategy. The Yale Endowment, that's actually one sort of withdrawal strategy where there's no sort of defined asset allocation that I'm aware of. Now you could test different asset allocations in FI Calc, right? So you could come here and say, okay, we're going to use the endowment strategy, and you can set the asset allocation here. They don't give you a lot of options, but they give you some. Change over allocation over time. I wonder if that's a new feature. But I mean, now the possibilities are endless. Anyway. Okie dokie. Okie dokie, Smokey, as my mom likes to say. Okay, great question. I can't pronounce Hoshi. I'm not sure how to pronounce the name, but I'm trying to get my 26-year-old niece, who has no interest in investing, into a Roth IRA. To make it simple for her, I'm going to suggest a target date fund. What are your thoughts on? Good question. And then I have another suggestion that I've used. But let's look at this. So this is the Fidelity Freedom Fund. So the thing to keep in mind with Fidelity, Fidelity has, well, they may have more than two, but they have two types of target date funds. One is an actively managed fund with a higher expense ratio, and which is this one. See the expense ratio, 75 basis points. And but they also have an index version of this. Let's see here. See if I can pull it up for you. And then we'll compare performance. Fidelity Freedom, it may just be Fidelity Freedom Index. Let's see. I forget the name of it. Hang on, I gotta Google it. Fidelity, is it Freedom? I thought it was still Freedom Index 2060. Here it is. FDKLX. Oh, it's L instead of V. Okay. FDKLX. Yeah. So here, okay, here we go. So here's the one you mentioned. And we'll look at the portfolio. 2060 should be probably a 90-10 portfolio. Yeah. So 90 roughly in split evenly or almost evenly between US and non-US, which is kind of interesting. I don't think most do that. And then roughly 10% in cash and fixed income. And then, and again, it's called the Fidelity Freedom 2060. And then this one's the Fidelity Freedom Index 2060. And you can see it's a lot cheaper, 12 basis points. Oh, let me take the comment down so you guys can see the screen. And if we go to the portfolio, I don't know if it's the same or not. Interesting. See, now I personally, okay, a couple things about this. So it's still 90-10, again, roughly, right? But there's a higher weight to US than international. I personally, my preference would be something like this, even apart from the fact that this is a cheaper index fund, the other one's a more expensive actively managed. So if I were gonna pick a Fidelity 2060 target date fund, I would personally pick this one. We could, I don't know that it matters. I would pick it, by the way, regardless of past performance. I don't know if that shocks anyone, but we can look at the past performance. I don't know that, I don't know how much past performance we're going to have because these aren't very old funds. I'd be surprised if it's more than a couple of years, but let's see. So the second one is the index fund. What do we get? Well, we get 7 years. And the actively managed has slightly outperformed. Which that's really, so that's surprising to me, in addition, not only because of the expense ratios, but because it has a higher allocation to international. But what I wonder if that's changed over time. And I don't think we can see that. We can look at historical, you know, this, the style box. We can see the history there. I don't think we can see, can we see history of, I don't think we can see the history of the changes in the US and international, but I could be wrong. That really surprised, because US has just done so much better. So I don't know what the answer there is, but first of all, the difference is pretty insignificant, but I would personally pick this one. The other thing I'll mention, only because you said that you're sort of hard to get your niece interested, I've opened up, helped family members open up a Roth IRA, and I've used Betterment. And part of my thinking is it's kind of a cool site. Now, there is a fee, it's 25 basis points, I think. But I think folks that aren't that interested, it might be more a way to maybe get them more interested. It's got a great app on their phone. It's a thought. Plus, it's a Roth. So, if, 10, 15 years from now, if they've kind of learned more and they want to get out of that 25 basis point fee, they can always move the Roth somewhere else and then reinvest it however they want without taxes. So it's just an idea. But I would go with the index fund if it were up to me. Great question. It's 8:29. I It's amazing how many comments I don't get to. I'm working up from the bottom now. Here's another personal capital issue, and it's from Elad, and it's the question is whether it's personal capital or, in this case, USAA or Alight Solutions. I've never heard of them. Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. I can reach out to my contact there and see if they have any insight. Well, pretty soon here, I'm off to watch the Manning cast. I'm just flipping through here, see what else you got. Rob blew that question. What question did I get wrong? I got one wrong? Oh, here we go. Your poll left out those of us who are near to retirement. I thought I had that in there. 10 plus years to retirement, 5 plus years, which would be, to me, 5 to 0. Should I have had... Oh, I said 5 plus. Yeah, I meant less than 5. Yeah, good catch. Typing too fast or just not thinking. It's interesting, though. It's roughly 50-50 close between those watching the show who are retired and those who are not retired. Or at least, well, I shouldn't say watching the show because not everyone voted, but of the people that voted. Well, I guess that makes sense because, well, that's not true. 31% of your 10 plus years. Yeah, I botched that one. Sorry, gang. I botched the poll. I put a plus in there. I got carried away with the plus sign. I don't know. And look, Gary called me out on it. Sorry, man. I don't know. I feel like the kicker for Ohio State. Wide left. Oh, man. Well, it is 8:31. I'm over. I'm out of time. So I'm going to go. And I'm going to go watch football. I hope you all have a great week. Remember, Lord willing and the creek don't rise. I will be back next Monday. The following Monday, there will be no live show. This week, I hope to get out the Vanguard Dynamic Spending. And my hope is to get out the MaxiFi video. I really like that tool a lot. So I hope to get that video out this week too. So have a great week. And until next time, remember, the best thing money can buy is financial freedom. I botched the poll. I can't believe it.